Good morning, members. We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't call the committee to order, but as soon as we do, we will. We want to get right into the presentations this morning, though. And first up on the agenda this morning is our state demographer, Susan Brower. So, when you're ready.
All right, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. So I've been asked to talk today about a number of trends and different dimensions of the aging trend. First, I'll talk about trends in aging around the state. We'll look at the timing, scope, and regional differences in those trends. I'll talk about the factors that increase the likelihood that someone will need long-term care. And understanding how these factors are distributed across the state will help us isolate where the need will be most acute and to plan for that need. I've also been asked to speak to the economic resources that Minnesota's older adults have, to help put some more definition around the economic situation of Minnesota's older adults as they move into later life stages.
Ms. Brower, excuse me for just a minute. We do have quorum now, so we're going to call the meeting to order. Go ahead.
Thank you. And finally, I'll speak briefly about the labor force and the need that will be there to care for our graying population, paying special attention to the aged in the rural areas of the state. So with that, we're looking here at along the axis of 100 years of aging in the state of Minnesota. And what this graph is telling you is that in the 1950s, there were 85,000 more older adults than there were in the decade prior. In the 60s, 55,000. We've always added gradually older adults to the state because the population has been growing. And this decade, we will add close to 300,000 additional older adults, and in the 20s, over 300,000 additional older adults. So we'll add to the state 600,000 more people age 65 plus, which is more than the past six decades combined. So this trend is compressed into a very short period of time. It's very large and discontinuous with our history. It's important to understand that the transition that we're making now to an older state will be a permanent one. We're looking at the same trend, just in a slightly different way. And the yellow line is showing us the population who are 65 plus in Minnesota historically and what's projected out to 2060. And the light blue line is showing you the school age population in the state, 5 to 17. And the dark blue line is showing you 18 to 24, so those who are typically consumers of higher ed. So these are kind of our three main budget drivers in the state, if we look at them by age. And we'll see this tremendous increase of that 65-plus population, which will surpass the school-age population by 2020 in just 5 years. But what's important to note about this change is that it's a permanent one. So we're transitioning to an older age structure, and into the foreseeable future, even after the baby boomers move through those life transitions, we'll continue to be an older state into the foreseeable future. We were headed toward this age structure before the baby boom happened, and the baby boomers just got us there more quickly than we otherwise would have gotten there. So this is a demographic shift that at some point will require a policy response or a set of policy responses. One useful way to think about the implications of aging to the state is to consider the ages of people who receive public services in Minnesota, to think about the budget as corresponding to the age groups that I just showed you projections for. So we have K-12 education, that light blue line was 5 to 17. The higher ed is about 8% of the general fund budget, and that was the 18 to 24-year-olds. And then a large proportion, not all, but a large proportion of that health and human services is for elderly and disabled medical assistance. So that can be attributed to the elderly population. And it's that proportion of the budget that we'll need to pay attention to and potentially could impact all other areas of the budget as the population in the older age group age groups grows. Minnesotans across the state face very different conditions as they age and require additional health care supports. So there's an important geographic dimension to the differences. The circles on this map are showing you the size of the older adult population. And so it's important to note that the larger circles are showing you where the most older adults are in the state, and it's very clear that they are concentrated in the Twin Cities area. That's because that's where most of our population is. I don't know if I touched something. Oh, there we go. The color of those circles is telling you what the percentage in that county is. So when you see a very dark colored circle, it's telling you that it makes up a high proportion of the overall population. So you'll see in many of our rural areas, while it's a smaller number of older adults, as a share of the entire population, it makes up much more. So in Twin Cities, in Rochester, in Duluth, we see the larger numbers, geographically concentrated, a small share of the population overall. And in the rural areas, we see smaller numbers, geographically dispersed, in a large proportion of the populations where they are. So this has implications for planning and for care. Okay, so I've given you a brief overview of the aging trend, how we're dispersed geographically. I want to talk a little bit now about the factors that will impact the need for long-term care. These, some of the major factors, of course, are age, gender, health status, disability, and then living arrangements. And of course, these aren't discrete factors. These things often exist together in a fairly predictable pattern. So first, let's look at age. These are numbers for the U.S. overall, but just to give you a sense of how the need for long-term care grows with age, about 12% of older adults 65 to 74 require some form of long-term care. These are numbers for the U.S. overall, and the proportion in blue there is showing you those who required some kind of care in an institution, in a nursing home. And the pink proportion is showing you not in institutions. And so here in Minnesota, we would be likely to see a higher proportion of those who receive care not in institutions. But what I want you to pay attention to is just the steep curve, the need for care in the older ages, and that 70% of people age 85 or above need some form of long-term care. So it's very, very common. If you look at 65-year-olds and you project out what proportion of those will need long-term care at some point, there's a fairly large share that will need no care, 30%, no care at all. There's also a large share, 20%, that will require more than 5 years of care. So there's very different needs, which can make it difficult to plan for as an individual. And it can also make it difficult to assume the risk of long-term care, the cost in terms of insurance. because I'm quite certain that most people feel that they will fall into that 30%, but that's just not how the numbers fall out.
I believe we have a question here, Representative. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back to that last slide? No, one before that. Okay, you have 12 in long-term, and according to that slide, 90% of 65 to 74-year-olds are in some sort of institution, if only 10% are not?
Ms. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so this is showing the proportion that require long-term care by age. So overall, of all 75 to 84-year-olds, for example, 30% need long-term care.
Okay.
Some will be in institutions, some will be in the community.
So it's just people of long-term care. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
So just to give another example of how the need for long-term care increases with age, we're looking here at the proportion of older adults living in institutions, and many of these are nursing homes. In 2010, so a very fairly recent example, fairly recent data, and we see both that there's a steep increase in the need for long-term care in institutions, and that need is greater among women who tend to live longer. Mr. Chair?
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any kind of data that would help us understand how much of that change with age is driven by increasing infirmity versus how much is due to loss of a spouse that might have been providing care before that point?
Ms. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that data that can parse out what share is attributable just to age, although, as I'll be showing you in a minute, another factor that influences the need for long-term care certainly is living alone, that those people are of greatest risk for needing some additional care.
Representative? All right, thank you.
So age and gender, you know, it seems very obvious to a lot of people that the need for long-term care increases with age when we look at it in the aggregate, but I'm stressing it today because when I talk to people around the state, everyone is quite certain that they are not that person and that their generation is not subject to these same rules of aging, and so I want to just lay the data out there, recent data out there, to show that there is a very steep increase even yet today. Another correlate of long-term care, of course, is health. And we're a very healthy state. We're looking at a map here of disability-free life expectancy across the U.S., and Minnesota is one of the states that has the longest life expectancy. In fact, we're second only to Hawaii in terms of life expectancy at birth. We're also very healthy in terms of life expectancy at age 65. The average Minnesotan who's 65 can expect to live 20 additional years, and 15 of those on average are disability free. It's higher than the national average. There's a strong correlation with health and the need for long-term care, and I know, again, that sounds almost silly to say, because of course if you have a health need, the response is some kind of care, but when we think about it in the aggregate, in terms of population health, it kind of helps us pinpoint what populations might be more at risk. So if you think about health like kind of a stable underlying characteristic of a population, that's influenced by socioeconomic factors, by lifelong behaviors, and so forth. It's more of a stable characteristic that we can correlate with health at the population level. So that's why I bring it up. And if we look at the state county by county, the very darkest areas in the state rank the lowest in terms of health outcomes. This measure is an index both of self-reported health, which is a very reliable measure of health, and life expectancy. And you can see there's a fairly recognizable geographic patterning to the health of Minnesotans. Now, I want to point out that these are rankings. So overall, as a state compared to the U.S., we do very well. Within the state, these are the rankings that we see, with the very darkest areas in the north, in the northeast, and then some portion of the very southern border experiencing the poorest health outcomes. In addition to higher rates of disability.
Just a moment, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. Are there specific reasons that you can give us for the poor outcomes in these counties?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Part of what we're seeing is the underlying age structure. Because if you're relying on self-rated health, you're going to have a higher proportion of older people reporting poor health. But it's also a measure of life expectancy, which is standardized to age. So all of the difference that we're seeing here is not attributable just to age. It would be attributable to other socioeconomic conditions that underlie health.
Representative Mason?
Thank you.
All right.
You can go. Go ahead.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to stop you before we got the testifier speaking again. Thank you. I thought maybe this would be a good moment to ask you, and I apologize if I missed this at the beginning, but this term that we use a lot, life expectancy, I think it's widely misunderstood. And I wonder, and when we're looking at something like this map, and I know you've mentioned that the underlying issue, part of it here, is the age structure of the state, but we're also somehow factoring in life expectancy. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit, only if you haven't already, about what that means, because I think the term's a little bit misleading sometimes.
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. It's a good question, and I have not addressed it. The way that demographers think about life expectancy is as a good overall measure of population health. So we look at the mortality patterns of people at every year of life, and depending on the health at every year of life, they contribute a portion of a year of life. And so what we're capturing is the overall health of the population throughout the years, rather than predicting how long any one person will live. It's kind of like an average that captures differences by age at a single point in time.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And just to be even more clear about that, so if we had, I'd like you to sort of explain how infant mortality contributes to that picture. Because I noticed in one of your slides you have life expectancy at 65, which tells you something very different than overall life expectancy, right? So I think people need to understand how infant mortality plays into this whole thing because, you know, obviously at any point in time, you're looking at a whole range of conditions that have occurred across, you know, lifespans.
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, One way to think about life expectancy is that you take a snapshot of the conditions that exist in the most recent year, so 2015, and you imagine a hypothetical person moving through those conditions. The pattern of mortality for infants is much higher, so that you have a much higher likelihood of death just after birth than you have through the rest of childhood. And that mortality will play into the life expectancy overall. So when you're looking at 65 plus, you're not looking at any of that infant mortality or any kind of mortality that would have happened up to age 65. You're only looking at everyone at age 65, what kind of mortality conditions they will face over the course of their years remaining.
So, Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. So sort of just to wrap this up, so sort of for purposes of this committee, where we're really concerned with older people aging, what happens to people in their later years, the really relevant measure here is not so much life expectancy overall, for just for purposes of this committee, but it's more life expectancy from 65 on, or from some, maybe not 65, but some later time on, to the degree that we're really talking about aging. I mean, obviously long-term care is bigger than just old people, but am I kind of correct in that?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I would agree that to the extent that we're planning for care of the older adult population, life expectancy at age 65 is an important measure. If we're trying to get to some of the underlying factors that might point to who is in greater need or who might be at a greater risk for needing long-term care, then life expectancy at birth is getting at another way of getting at the underlying stable characteristic of health. So it's a proxy for how healthy a population is. And there are not a lot of measures that can span the years and span that are large enough to span very small populations. Life expectancy is one of them, so that's why we use it as a proxy for health.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And just before we get to Representative Miller, if you can keep your cell phones away from the microphones, that will help with the feedback that we have here. Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, I hope it's not mine. Nope. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brower, at the risk of digging in too deep on what's just meant to be a graphic, I'm looking at my my four counties, and three of them are ranked pretty low. One jumps up to the top, and actually all the counties to the south are in the top. So, and the demographics are pretty much the same in my area. So is there, what are, again, you don't have to, I'm not asking a question to dig in too deep, but are there factors other than demographics that we're noticing here? Because I'm seeing a kind of a distinct trend right there. Does that make sense?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it does. I would say the intent of measuring both life expectancy and self-rated health is to get at some of those underlying factors in addition to just age, since life expectancy is a measure that is not age dependent. So yes, it is, the intent is to get at some other underlying factor that may relate to socioeconomic status, or it may relate to behavior, health behaviors. I would caution that when we look state or county by county, or even state by state in maps, it can sometimes appear that there are greater differences just because of where the cut points in the map happen to fall. And you know, your counties may be very, very close but happen to span a color difference on the map, a cut point. And I'd be happy to share the data underlying this map with you if you'd like to look into it further.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brower. That would be great if I could have that sometime. That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Brower, you can continue.
So we've looked at life expectancy and self-rated health as measures trying to capture a kind of stable characteristic of population health. Let's look now at how disability changes over the years. These are two of our census measures of disability, and we see that there's a steep increase in disability by age. As our state ages, there will generally be more rates of disability in the population. The two kinds of disabilities that we're looking at here, independent living limitations. These are people who self-reported that due to a physical, mental, or emotional condition, had difficulty doing errands alone, such as visiting a doctor or shopping. Those are independent living limitations. And then on the right, we have self-care limitations. And here, respondents were asked if they had difficulty dressing or bathing. And so you can see that that has a pretty strong age patterning to it as well. I'm comparing here Minnesota versus the U.S. so that you can see that we do tend to be a bit healthier. We do tend to have lower rates of disability even at older ages. But the predominant pattern is age over our geography. So I've been showing you the most recent data that I have on the physical consequences of aging, on disability, and we've seen very steep increases in institutionalization and disability with each decade of life after age 65. And sometimes, as I mentioned a bit earlier, people ask me whether aging will be completely different for the baby boomers than it was the generation before them. People cite longer life expectancies, healthier habits, improvement in medical care, for example. And yes, all those things have happened. But this graph is showing you the difference between two decades in disability rates and the prevalence of disability rates, two different kinds of disability. And you can see that the improvement between 1984 and 1994 was very small relative to the age patterning. So I know some of these graphs are very grim, but I wanted to show you that, yes, there have been improvements in terms of disabilities over time. If you've heard about them, you've heard right. But those improvements are very small relative to the curve that remains as we age, as we move into our 70s and our 80s. We're looking here now at a map by county of people with disabilities age 65 plus. And it just helps us get at some of those regional differences across the counties. We see, again, higher rates of disability in the northeast part of the state. So the map has some similar patterning to what we saw in terms of the health map. Some of this, again, may have to do with that age distribution. We have a higher concentration of people in their 70s and their 80s in the counties that are the darkest. But we are looking here just at the 65-plus population. The final characteristic that increases the need for long-term care is the proportion of people who are living alone. And the very darkest portion of these bars are showing you the proportion of older people age 65-plus who live alone. The lighter blue is showing you people who live in a household in the community, but they live with another family member or non-family member. And then the very smallest proportion at the end there are those living in institutions. And I'm showing you the 15 most highest counties with the highest number of older adults in them, just to give you a sense of how people are distributed within the community versus institutions and what proportion are living alone in a household. And so those living alone, of course, are most likely to need some kind of long-term care. Actually, those probably living in households, living with a spouse, are already receiving long-term care at the older ages. But I would say that those living alone are likely to need some service outside of their own family. I'd like to turn now to the costs of long-term care to get some definition around affordability, private and public resources to pay for it. There is a considerable range of costs, which makes it difficult to plan. It can make it for an individual to plan and to calculate their risk for needing long-term care in the future. The cost for remaining in the home, of course, is much lower, and most people would prefer to stay in their home if they can. To look at how long-term care is paid for, the largest proportion right now is paid for by a public program, by Medicare or Medicaid. Two-thirds of all long-term care is paid for by a public program. And then 7% is paid for by long-term care insurance. This is on par with the proportion nationally in the U.S. that have long-term care insurance. The cost of long-term care insurance is one factor that dissuades some people from purchasing it. Uncertainty about the value of the product. Will it offer the services? Will it pay for the services that I actually end up needing at some point? And then misunderstanding about what health insurance covers versus long-term care. Those are kind of some of the barriers that people have to purchasing their own long-term care insurance. I think it's important to note that the vast majority of long-term care is kind of off the radar in that it is provided by relatives, by neighbors, by friends. 76% of all long-term care in one survey found that it was informal care or unpaid care. These numbers come from the National Health Interview Survey on Disability, so these numbers are for the U.S. overall. So Minnesota's Department of Human Services conducted a survey of baby boomers in 2010 and asked them how they plan to pay for their own long-term care. More than 30% said that they didn't know, and 18% said that they would rely on a government program, which leaves together those numbers of those who don't know and those who expect that their long-term care will be paid for by a government program is 50%. So when I looked at when I showed you the numbers of the demographic trends beginning that huge increase, those 300,000 additional older adults this decade and 300,000 additional older adults in the 2020s, we can expect half of those either expecting to pay for their own long-term care with a government program, by a government program, or without a plan for their own long-term care. So large numbers there. So looking a little bit at the income of our older adults, just to put some definition around what might be affordable in terms of long-term care and long-term care insurance. If we look at the middle 20% of all Minnesota households who are 40 plus, we look at kind of the younger age there, 40 plus, because it's at that age that people can typically afford or more likely to afford long-term care, those younger ages. The median income for that group, 40-plus households, median household income is between $44,000 and $68,000. So that's kind of the range of middle income. But there's a considerable amount of variation within that group of 40-plus-year-olds, especially when you look at age and you look at the size of the household, which are related. So if we look just at Minnesota households by age, you can see that income declines typically after age 40 with each decade of life. Again, part of this is compositional, that you have fewer people in the households as you're moving into 70s and 80s. But part of it is just reflecting different kinds of income, so earned income versus retirement income. As we age. Here we see the differences by the age of the householder, by household size. So those very darkest bars there are showing you that there's a considerably lower household income for people who are living alone. That makes sense. There's fewer earners. There's fewer recipients of Social Security, of retirement income. But when you're thinking about what is middle income for this group of people, age and household size are both very important dimensions of what's affordable.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brower, what would be a typical 80 and over with three or more people in the house?
Ms. Brower?
Or am I misunderstanding that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, the numbers of people who are in a household at age 80 with three or more are very small. So we're looking just at medians without looking at what the size is. There are very few people in that situation, but it would likely be a multi-generational household.
Okay.
That would be the most likely scenario.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Just to give you a sense of who buys long-term care insurance, these again are numbers nationally, and I should note that whenever I'm able, I'm showing you numbers specific to Minnesota, but lots of times we just don't have the numbers, so we're looking for the U.S., and this is one of those cases. People who make $75,000 excuse me, and above are those who are most likely to be buying long-term care insurance. So that's considerably higher than the medians that we looked at. Now, if we look at median household income of older adults, those 65 plus, by county, again, we see the highest incomes in the Twin Cities metro. So, you know, this is a patterning, again, in terms of the health, in terms of the disability rates. And now with income, we see higher incomes in the Twin Cities, lower income areas in large portions of greater Minnesota. Finally, I want to share with you some numbers about the need for workers and how the geographic distribution of our older population creates some special needs for rural Minnesota. We're looking here at what's not a very, typically it's termed an old age dependency ratio. That's not a very nice term, so we'll call it retirement to working age ratio. And what we see is that the number of older adults, the number of people of working age relative to the number of people of older adults is much higher in some of the areas of greater Minnesota. Again, that northern part of the state, there are many fewer workers in relation to the number of older adults that there are. And so that has implication for the care of older adults. I mean, if you think about care, you can't do it remotely for the most part. Maybe there's a few things that you can help with remotely, but you really need to have people co-located, same time, same space. And so that creates some special needs for some areas of the state that are relatively remote and have a higher proportion of older adults. This is just another example of that. We're looking here at every city in the state, represented there by a circle of this size here is 13,000 older adults, and again, that if the circle's very dark, it's telling you that it's a high proportion of that city are older adults. And so there's some areas of the state that don't that are relatively remote that have a high proportion of older adults, and there's not they're not in close proximity to other cities that they might borrow caregivers from. So this creates kind of a special situation for the care of our older adults in rural Minnesota. So I worked, just to give another example, just with someone in Moose Lake at the Augustana Mercy Care Center, looking at what the labor force looked like for caregivers for that nursing home there. And the dots here on this map are showing you just the people, the number of people who are in the labor force. And there you can see there's a very small dot there in Moose Lake. If you think about the fact that people giving care are typically women, that would be half of a dot, half of that proportion in any given city that is available there for care. Of course, it doesn't have to be that way, but that's the way it's been historically. If you think about the education required, someone who typically has a high school degree is someone who's a PCA or a home health care aide, so that limits kind of the pool of available workers even further. And then you look at the neighboring cities and see that there's quite a distance. Is someone going to commute from Duluth for a PCA job? It's unlikely. So that the pool of workers really needs to come for that skill level, for that pay scale, from an area nearby, and some areas just don't have the population for that, to support that. So I want to leave you with this graph that I kind of opened with, and that is just to reiterate that the transition that we're undergoing now to an older state is one that will remain. It's a permanent transition that the baby boomers have sped along for us as they move into the retirement years. But what we create now in terms of a policy response will be, appropriate. The population will be there to support it into the foreseeable future. And that's all that I have prepared today, Mr. Chair, but I'm happy to take questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Brower. This was fascinating, to say the least. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we had the statistic about, 50% of people expecting either to rely on government programs or not knowing what that was going to be. But then when we look at the actual distribution of funds, it turns out to be 67% of it is coming, adding up the Medicare and the Medicaid, was coming from government funds. And part of the problem there is we're talking about two different populations of people, the ones that are actually receiving care now versus the ones that we're surveying about their future plans. But one of the things that we need to look into is what is the gap between what people are attempting to plan to pay for with their long-term care insurance and what the actual cost of it is going to be. And then in some cases it's difficult to cash in on that long-term care insurance due to the conditions under which you have to apply for it and whatnot. That long-term care insurance wasn't available for our oldest group of adults that we're looking at the statistics for. So it's a little bit difficult. It's very much a moving target trying to compare these different numbers. but I think that's one of the messages that people don't maybe realize is that the sheer size of what you need to prepare for if you're looking at years of care. Do we have any, do you have numbers about what the actual cost is for individuals in different kinds of situations? I mean, it's very individualistic, but can we put them into any kind of broad classes and start to look at that?
Ms. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we look at, we can kind of combine estimates, or we could combine estimates of what the cost for the range of care is with the amount that has been needed by people in different age groups and try to come up with that. Just to clarify, when we were looking at the proportion paid by a public program, we were looking at overall the funds, the proportion of the funds or of the costs that were paid for by public rather than the people. But yes, I think I'd agree. It's important to understand that gap between the expectation and the actual wealth available. And I'd agree it's a moving target.
Any follow-up, Representative? Any other questions for Ms. Brower? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brower, when we're looking at this chart right now that refers to the home health average hourly rate of $25, does that include the cost of providing that, or is that just the employee pay for the aid itself?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, could you clarify the question? Is it the
sure? In my district,
yes.
I have home health aid programs. They pay their workers probably around $12 an hour, but their cost is closer to $15. Closer to $18. So when we're looking at that number, is the $25 a day or an hourly rate, is that just for that worker or for the program itself?
This
the worker plus the work.
Mr. Yeah. Chair, Representative, this would be for the whole cost of the care to provide that service.
Representative, any other questions? Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we look at nursing homes, what is the average life expectancy for someone entering a nursing home?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not seen life expectancies calculated for people entering nursing homes. I could look around a bit and see if that's something that's available, but I haven't seen that.
Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Brower, I get confused with the terminology of the different types of care. Could you give us kind of how you break those down, if it's like three or four different categories, I would assume?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Someone in the field of aging will have much more specific and precise definitions than I do. Looking at it as a demographer, I look at people who are living in institutions, so nursing home care, full 24-hour medical and assistance with daily living, people in some assisted housing situation, is kind of an interim step there. They may have services brought to them. They may have services on site, depending on where they're living. That's another kind of step along the continuum. Adult daycare would be if the older adult goes to a place during the day to receive care during the 8 or 10 hours that household members are away at work, or to give, you know, household members a little bit of a break from that care. Home health aides would come into the home to provide care and assistance, and then homemaker services would be those things that aren't necessarily specifically medical in nature, but assistance with the home.
Senator Miller?
I'm sure there are more precise definitions. As a demographer, we think about people living in the home versus institutions, and then again, whether they're living alone or with more adults.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Brower. I did not intend to test you on that. I know that in the conversations that we're going to have, we're going to use some terms loosely, which is okay, but there are some differences between you know, assisted living versus some of the other cares, and I think that's going to become important when we discuss how we approach some solutions to some of these things. So I would like at some point, Mr. Chair, if we could have, I don't know, for my own sake, just some sort of breakdown of how we discuss these different. Does that make sense?
I'm sure I'll be having plenty of breakdowns throughout the year. Representative Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Brower, I just wonder if there's any data available. This is kind of a personal thing. Both my mother and mother-in-law passed away from Alzheimer's. One was in a full-time care at a nursing home in Roseau, and my mom was in-house taking care of mostly by my father and some health aides assistance. Since we have such high numbers coming up in the next 20 or 30 years of people that will be needing care, do we have any data, like, for Alzheimer's, how many percent people are in nursing care because of like an Alzheimer's type of situation? Because I know the medical field is having wonderful breakthroughs, and you know, maybe 10, 20 years down the road, there might be a cure for that, which the people that I know could have been living in their homes for much longer, but mentally they just weren't able to be safe. Mm-hmm. Is there
Ms.
any
Brower.
Data for that, you know?
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are estimates of the proportion of adults with Alzheimer's. I don't have them in front of me, but I would be happy to pass those along to you. Alzheimer's and dementia is one of the very common conditions of older age that will require long-term care at some point, most certainly. You know, some of the other mortality factors, cancer, heart disease, and so forth, may or may not require lengthy periods of time in long-term care, but Alzheimer's and dementia certainly are among those diseases that will be closely linked to long-term care.
Thank you. I appreciate that data. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for our demographer? Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come today.
Thank you.
Next, we have House Research, who is going to give us a little bit of an overview of the types of services that the state is offering currently for aging adults. And while they're setting up, we will move along in the agenda and go over the committee rules. The rules are in your packets and are fairly typical for what we've seen in the past. There is a deadline for amendments. We're doing that at noon the day before, just because it's an 8:15 committee and we want to have time to get those posted clearly and have time to review those. So do we take action on that? So these are the rules. Also, while they're getting set up in your packets, there is a lot of information that House Research has provided for us to review and to help us along in the process, and a copy of the slide presentation that they have today. Representative Franzen.
Chair Schumacher, is there a 24-hour rule on amendments at all? I don't see anything.
Representative Franzen, not a 24-hour rule. We went with the noon the day before rule. For the time being, I'd like to go through introductions, too, so we can move along in the agenda there as well. And so basically I'm just looking for everyone to take a moment to introduce themselves, give their district and hometown, and we'll go from there. I'm Representative Joe Schumacher from District 22A. I'm representing the cities of Laverne, Pipestone, Slayton, and the southwest corner of the state. And next we'll have our vice chair, Representative Tice.
I'm Representative Tama Tice. I live in District 14A, which is St. Cloud, part of St. Cloud, Way Park, St. Augusta. And there are several jokes about Stearns County, but I grew up in Meeker County. And that's the area that Dean Erdahl covers. So I just want to make that distinction. I didn't grow up in Stearns County.
Thank you. Next we have our lead Representative Lilly.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm part of that gold bar that she was referring to that is growth, so I'm right on the cusp of need. And I'm happy to be on this committee and to we met yesterday, and he was pretty clever. You got to watch him because he times it perfect because he has you sit in a chair and then the light from the afternoon sun hits and then it comes right in your eye. So you're he played it well. I felt like I was in the principal's office. Pretty clever. I represent three East Metro communities, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale, and happy to serve on the committee and be with you all.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Tina Liebling from Rochester. And I've been waiting for the joke that our previous demographer, I think it was, used to always make about everybody aging about a year every 12 months. So we can get that out of the way, I think.
Thank you. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Rosenthal. I represent District 49B, which is Southern Edina, Western Bloomington, and portions of Eden Prairie and Minnetonka.
Thank you, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, you have it right now.
Thank you.
Jack Considine, freshman legislator, 19B, Mankato and Eagle Lake. This committee will be near and dear to my heart. My parents are in their mid-80s, and I'm knee-deep in this. My mother's in a facility at the moment for dementia.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Jerry Newton. I represent District 37A, which is Coon Rapids, Blaine, Spring Lake Park, the 3rd, the 5th, and the 6th congressional districts.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
I'm Sandra Mason, and I represent 51A, which is most of Eagan, west of 35E, and all of northern Burnsville. And this is I'm starting my fourth term.
Thank you. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Barb Yaruso. I represent 42A, which includes all of Arden Hills, all of Moundsview, the northern two-thirds of Shoreview, and another little sliver of Spring Lake Park. And I have quite a few facilities in my district, and I've also been through different forms of assisted living with both of my parents and an in-law. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Good morning. I'm Deb Keel. I come from District 1B, which is Polk, Red Lake, and Pennington County up on the North Dakota side of Minnesota. When we say north, a lot of times people think Duluth, but there's a whole western side. And anyway, I represent the communities of Kirkston, East Grand Forks, and have had a little bit of experience working with different nursing home facilities, as I now am taking care of an aunt that is in Alzheimer's unit. She has dementia. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Chairman.
This is Mary Franson, mother of three. I represent the eastern half of Otter Tail County on the northeastern half of Douglas County, and in my community we have quite a few nursing homes, one of which is named Knute Nelson after our very own 12th governor of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tim Miller. I'm from District 17A, which is Swift, Chippewa, Renville, and a little bit of Candy White County. And I do like to ask questions, which has become noticeable. That's how I learn. Representative Christensen is prompt to sit next to me and keep me quiet when I start talking too much. So thank you.
Perfect. He's not doing his job today. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Drew Christensen. I represent District 56A, which is Savage in Northwest Burnsville. I'm excited to be on this committee and tell Mr. Representative Miller when he's talking too much.
Thank you. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Daniels. I represent 24B, which is Rice, Steele, and Dodge County. This committee is very special to me, just because of the things that my family's gone through, and I sympathize with Jack. This is something we really need to get right for the future generations who are going to be retiring and needing that special care, and I'm just very thankful to be on the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Baker. I'm from most of Candiaway County, representing the cities of Spicer, New London, Atwater, Wilmer. It's a pleasure to be here on this brand-new committee. I'm very excited to be here. I'm a freshman legislator as well. I'm a small business owner in Wilmer and Spicer area, and really happy to be here, so thank you.
Thank you. I should also note that Representative Gunther is on the committee, although he is out ill today. If we could go into staff introductions quick and start with partisan research staff.
My name is Chelsea Whitman, and I am the
Good morning, Mr. Chair and staff. My name is Leah Montgomery, and I am the DFL researcher for the committee.
And our committee legislative assistant this year is?
Mr. Chair and members, Nick Lunneborg, hometown of Maple Grove. Not quite nursing home age, but we're getting there.
And you all know Holly.
Holly Iverson, committee administrator.
And our House research staff for this year.
Danielle Pinelli from House Research.
And Sean Williams from House Research.
All right, and whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're ready to begin. Mr. Williams and I are here this morning to talk about long-term care services for the elderly. We're hoping that this is just kind of a high-level overview of some of the programs that are available for the elderly in Minnesota. And I would just start off by saying that long-term care services are available to the elderly in Minnesota through the state's medical assistance program, which is a state federal program. It's also the Medicaid program in Minnesota. It's just called medical assistance, or MA. There are some state programs and some programs that are administered by the Board on Aging. For those enrollees who are also enrolled in Medicare, Medicare serves as the primary payer and MA as the secondary payer for elderly enrollees. And I would just kind of draw a distinction here between Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare is a federal program, and this is probably the program that a lot of people think of when they think of health care for people age 65 and older. And this program provides what I would think of as basic care for people that are age 65 and older, and there really is a very, very limited long-term care benefit within Medicare. I think Medicare will pay for up to 90 days in a nursing home, and that's it as far as I understand. So for other long-term care services, people would need to be eligible for medical assistance. Medical assistance for those people who are dual eligible is the secondary payer, and it would pay for those services not covered by Medicare and also for any Medicare cost-sharing obligations. And the MA enrollees who are elderly would receive coverage for the standard MA-covered services available to all of the other eligibility groups within MA. So in addition to covering the standard medical services such as physician, inpatient hospital, dental, and therapy services, MA also covers many services that are used heavily by elderly persons, the long-term care type services, including nursing facility services, home health care, personal care assistant, the elderly waiver program, and prescription drugs, which I won't talk about today. In order to be eligible for full coverage of MA services as elderly, a person must meet certain criteria, including being age 65 or older, meeting income and asset standards of the program, meeting requirements related to citizenship and residency, and various other program eligibility requirements. And I would just note on the income and asset standards that the MA income limit for the aged, blind, and disabled is less than the income limit for any other MA eligibility category, which is an issue that tends to come up in the legislature, so you may be hearing about that at some point later on in the session.
So this chart here shows the share of average monthly enrollment in medical assistance by type of person in the program and the share of annual expenditures. So, and just to note, this is combined state and federal expenditures. So, as you can see, children and parents are the largest group in terms of the number of enrollees, about 63% of enrollees, average monthly enrollees, which is about 533,000 average monthly enrollees in medical assistance. The elderly are actually a relatively small share of MA participants. They're about 7% of total participants in medical assistance, and that's about 59,000 elderly persons in terms of average monthly enrollment. But even though children and parents represent the largest share of average monthly enrollment, it's actually persons with disabilities that represent the average share, the largest share of expenditures. So persons with disabilities represent about 44.1% of annual expenditures in FY 2014. But you can see that medical assistance expenditures on elderly persons are relatively higher than you would expect, given the share of enrollees represented by them. And that represents the fact that they those services cost more on average per enrollee.
Mr. Chair, now I'm going to go into describing some of the programs. And the first one is MA Nursing Facility Services. And in order to be eligible for MA Nursing Facility Services, a person must be screened by a long-term care consultation team and be determined by the team to need nursing facility level care. The screening team will assign each nursing facility resident one of several case mix classifications that reflect the varying care needs of the residents. Under MA, nursing facility services are a package of room and board and nursing services. And the nursing facilities are reimbursed by MA on a resident per day basis that's adjusted under that case mix system. So it's weighted so that people who need more care would get higher, there'd be a higher rate for that person. And then I would just note that the MA rates and private pay rates do not vary within a facility due to Minnesota's rate equalization law. There are some exceptions to that, for single bedrooms. And then I would also just kind of mention that reimbursement rates are facility and resident specific, and that rates vary within with the facility's historical costs, with the amount of care that's needed by a resident based on that case mix classification, and that they reflect any statutory facility-specific rate adjustments that have been authorized by the legislature in the past. MA reimburses nursing facilities for basically three different types of costs. There's operating costs, external fixed costs, and property costs. Most of the time here at the legislature, when people talk about nursing facility rates, they're usually referring to the operating payment rate. And kind of just for a little bit of historical background, prior to October 1st of 2006, nursing facilities were reimbursed under a cost-based system where reimbursement to facilities was based on their reported costs that was subject to various limits. From October 1st, 2006 through September 30th of 2008, nursing facilities participating in MA were reimbursed under what was called the alternative payment system, which was a contract-based system where facilities were exempt from certain statutory requirements under the cost-based system, and they were reimbursed at the level of their payment rate that was in effect just prior to their entering into the alternative payment system contract with the Commissioner of Human Services. And then in 2007, the legislature required the Department of Human Services to rebase the nursing facility rates, meaning that the operating payment rates for the nursing facilities would be calculated using a statistical and cost report that was filed annually by each facility. The rebasing for the operating cost payment rates began on October 1st of 2008, and it was designed to be phased in over 8 years. So facilities were supposed to receive a blended rate during that phase-in period. In 2011, the legislature prohibited further steps under the rebasing, leaving nursing facilities basically with a blended operating payment rates. And the reason why that was done at that time is there was a big budget deficit, and so sort of suspending the rebasing was projected to save the state over $100 million a year just in fiscal years 2014 and 2015 alone. And the savings resulted from canceling the scheduled rate increases under the rebasing.
On that, Representative Daniels, did you have a question?
Not much necessarily a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I know when you convert these files over into black and white and everything, and I think we had another committee where we were requesting maybe PDF files, saying everybody either has an iPad or a smartphone that they could read that a little bit easier. So just maybe for the future, we could look at doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And all of these documents are on the committee website that can be downloaded and use on whatever platform you'd like. Ms. Minnelli?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to the three payments on the previous slide, the operating costs, external fixed, and property costs, nursing facilities can receive several other payments, including incentive payments to create single bed rooms under certain circumstances, performance-based incentive payments, quality add-on payments, and partial rebasing and enhancement of certain payments for facilities that are designated as critical access nursing facilities. Next, I'm going to move on and talk about home health care. Home health care provides medical and health-related services and assistance with day-to-day activities to people in their homes. Home care services provided to MA enrollees must meet certain criteria like being medically necessary, ordered by a licensed physician, documented in a written service plan, provided at the recipient's residence, and provided by a Medicare certified agency. And home care can be used to provide short-term care for people moving from a hospital or nursing home back into their home or into the community, and it can also be used to provide continuing long-term care to people who have ongoing needs. The services under home care include things like intermittent home health aides, PCA visits, home care nursing, various therapies, intermittent skilled nurse visits, and equipment and supplies. And most home care services need to be prior authorized, and there are certain maximum benefit levels set for some of these services, like, for example, the maximum benefit level for home health aid visits is one visit per day, typically. Next is the Personal Care Assistant Services Program. Personal care assistants provide assistance and support to the elderly, persons with disabilities, and others with special health care needs who are living independently in the community. And in order for a person to receive PCA services, they must meet basically the same criteria as for the home care. The services need to be medically necessary, authorized by a licensed physician, documented in a written service plan, and provided at a recipient's place of residence or other location that's not an institution. Recipients of PCA services also need to be in stable medical condition, and they need to be able to direct their own care or have a responsible party who can provide support to them. And the determination of the amount of services that is available to a person is based on an assessment of need. And then I would just also note that this program is supposed to be replaced by a new program that's called Community First Services and Supports as soon as DHS receives federal approval from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for that new program. And the services provided under the PCA program include assistance with activities of daily living, assistance with instrumental activities of daily living, assistance with health-related procedures and tasks, and intervention for behaviors, including observation and redirection. Next is the MA Elderly Waiver Services Program. This program provides home and community-based services that would not normally be covered under the MA program to MA enrollees who are at risk of nursing facility placement. And just for a little background on the waivered services programs, initially the Medicaid program only covered institutional care, and then back in the 1980s, the waivered services were created to allow for long-term care to be covered by MA for services out in the community and not just institutional care. But the state has to apply to the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for the waiver to provide services, and typically it's for a specific population. So in Minnesota, we've got 5 different waiver programs. The only one I'm going to talk about today is elderly waiver, but there are 4 other ones that serve varying populations of people that have disabilities. So in addition to the services that are available under the elderly waiver, the elderly waiver recipients also are eligible for all of the standard MA services as well. And in order to be able to receive elderly waiver services, an enrollee must meet certain criteria, like be age 65 or older, need nursing facility level care as determined by the long-term care consultation process, and choose community care, and then meet the elderly waiver income standard. And then I would just note that for individuals who have incomes that exceed the income standard, they can those individuals can spend down to the regular MA spend down standard for the elderly, which is 75% of the federal poverty guidelines, in order to qualify for elderly waiver and MA services. And then this next slide just shows a list of some of the services that are available through elderly waiver. I won't read all of them.
So this graph Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this graph shows expenditures and enrollees by program type. So rather than breaking out by demographic group as the last graph we presented did, this actually breaks out MA expenditures and enrollees by the different type of program within MA. This data is, the expenditure data in this graph is for state expenditures only. But as you can see, long-term care waivers make up a relatively small share of average monthly enrollment. It's about 6.6% of average monthly enrollment in the MA program, but they're actually the second largest category of in terms of average or in terms of annual expenditures. They're about 28.5% of annual expenditures in the program. Similarly, long-term care facilities make up a larger portion of total MA expenditures than they have than they do the proportion of enrollees. So they have about 2.1% of average monthly enrollees, but about 10.3% of average annual annual expenditures in fiscal 2014. So you can see that in both of those programs in this slide represent spending on long-term care waivers and long-term care facilities for both elderly and the disabled together. So those are combined in this slide. So this graph sort of shows you sort of the longer term trend in terms of recipients of different types of programs. So sort of the top line that crosses over the middle line in the early 2000s is the long-term care waiver program. So as you can see, in the early 2000s, we actually start to have more recipients of long-term care waiver programs, home and community-based services, than long-term care facility programs. And that trend has sort of continued over time. So there's, in general, in the MA program, a trend towards people participating in waiver and home care programs rather than in long-term care facilities. And this is a similar graph, but instead of showing the number of enrollees, this shows long-term care expenditures on an annual basis over time. And as you can see, again, expenditures actually crossed over. Expenditures on long-term care waiver programs and home care crossed over expenditures on long-term care facilities in the early 2000s, but it occurred slightly later than the crossover in the number of enrollees. And again, that represents probably the fact that on a per enrollee basis, the waiver and home care programs are less expensive.
Next, Mr. Chair, we'll move on and talk about state programs for the elderly. And the programs that I'm going to talk about this morning are the Alternative Care Program, Long-Term Care Consultation Services, and Services for Vulnerable Adults. So the first one I'm going to talk about is the Alternative Care Program, which is very similar to the Elderly Waiver Program. It's just that this is a state program for people who aren't eligible for MA yet. And it's meant to try to keep people off of the MA program for a little bit longer time period. So the Alternative Care Program provides home and community-based services to individuals who are not MA enrollees but who are at risk of nursing facility placement. And in order to qualify for these services, an individual must be age 65 or over, be determined to need nursing facility-level care through the long-term care consultation process, and choose community care and meet the income and asset requirements of the program. And then I would just mention that this program used to be funded entirely with state general fund money, but in 2014, the Department of Human Services negotiated with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to receive federal match money for the program. So now there is federal money that is used for this program as well.
Okay, and we have a question, Ms. Pinelli. Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, and either one of you can answer this, but can you give me some ideas of people that would be at risk of being placed in the nursing home? Who would be? Describe the people that would, what their situations are that would place them in this category.
Ms. Pinelli.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, I think it would be elderly people that have maybe problems or need assistance with self-care, or maybe have a chronic health condition, like frail elderly would be in that category. I can probably get you more information about what, there's an assessment that is done to determine if somebody needs nursing home level care, and I could get you more information about like what the criteria is for a person, you know, meeting that level of need.
Okay. Thank you. Can I ask one more question?
Mason?
I remember one of my friends had her mother in a nursing home, and it was two to a room, and the other person tended to be fairly aggressive, which boggles my mind. And the deal was they wanted her mother to be taken out of the room rather than taking the abusive person out of the room. And I was just wondering if that would be something that would come under this category.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, I'm not sure about that. I'd have to look into it.
Thank you.
And to all of this, if the committee would like, we can have DHS come in at a later point, too, and go more in depth in what the waivered services really are offering and answer more questions in detail that way, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, this next slide just shows a listing of some of the services that are available through the alternative care program, including adult daycare, home health services, home-delivered meals, non-medical transportation, certain supplies and equipment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this next slide shows projected expenditures on medical assistance in the alternative care program for the upcoming biennium. So these numbers are in thousands of dollars. They're from the November 2014 DHS forecast. So you can see that medical assistance as a whole is about $5 billion. What I've done at the bottom of this slide is add up the spending on long-term care waiver programs, long-term care facilities, and the alternative care program that Ms. Pinelli just described. So you can see for both fiscal 2016 and fiscal 2017, the combined medical assistance, long-term care expenditures, and alternative care program reach about $2 billion.
Mr. Chair, next we'll move on to long-term care consultation services. These are services that provide screening, assessment, and information and education services to help individuals access and decide on the appropriate level of long-term care services. State law requires all applicants to MA-certified nursing facilities to be screened prior to admission to determine if they need nursing facility-level care. And then counties are also required as part of pre-admission screening to assess individuals to determine whether alternatives to nursing facility care would be appropriate. Next, Mr. Chair, is services for vulnerable adults. Vulnerable adults are individuals who are age 18 and older who are impaired physically, mentally, or emotionally and unable to protect themselves from maltreatment. Residents or inpatients of a facility, recipients of certain outpatient services, or recipients of certain home care services. There are certain people who are mandated reporters that are required to make reports of suspected maltreatment to a common entry point, which must be available 24 hours a day to accept reports. And then counties, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health assess and investigate allegations of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. And then counties provide protective services when needed. And then I would just also mention that the common entry point must immediately report to a law enforcement agency any incident in which there's a reason to believe that a crime has been committed, and any crimes against vulnerable adults is something that would be under the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, I'm going to talk about Minnesota Board on Aging programs. The Minnesota Board on Aging is a 25-member board whose members are appointed by the governor. The board staff is provided by the Department of Human Services, and the board is housed within that agency. And one of the duties of the board is to administer programs that are funded through the Federal Older Americans Act. And programs administered by the Board on Aging include the Senior Linkage Line, which is a free telephone service that provides elderly persons with information on and assistance in accessing a range of community services, including transportation, housing, home care, chore help, caregiver support, meal delivery, access to prescription drugs, and health insurance counseling. Minnesota Help, which provides individuals with information and guidance on long-term care planning, decision-making, and resources. Senior Nutrition Services, which includes senior dining services and also home-delivered meals. Caregiver Grants, which are provided to the 7 area agencies on aging and service providers to fund respite care, education and training in caregiving, and support groups for family caregivers. Minnesota Senior Corps, which is a network of programs that provide elderly persons with volunteer opportunities. And then finally, the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, which serves as an advocate for and investigates and resolves complaints concerning health, safety, welfare, and rights for people receiving long-term care services.
All right. Are there any additional questions for Ms. Pinelli or Mr. Daniels? Mr. Williams. All right. Seeing none, I would like to thank you for your presentation today and also thank once again our state demographer, Susan Bauer, for her presentation today. Next week, we will be hearing from the great Bob Held from the Department of Human Services and providers about our current rate setting system and where we might want to go with that down the road. So with that, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if you would be thinking about maybe having some presentations on long-term care insurance.
Yes, we are looking at that. It'll be a few weeks yet, but long-term care insurance is definitely part of what we want to be addressing here this year.
Okay. I'm asking because I know that I just know enough about it to know that the marketplace for long-term care insurance is very difficult for people to navigate, and there are a lot of issues about what's covered, what's not covered, even if people think they have coverage.
Right.
And it would be really, I think, a good background for all of us to understand that better. I'd certainly like to understand it better. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Any other points? All right. With that, thank you all, and the meeting is adjourned.